Hello, this is Tom Campbell, host of a series of interviews with local band members and music industry professionals from the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. Today's interview is with Wes Hayne. Today is November 13th, 2011, and I'm talking with Wes Hayne about his time working in the record business here in the Twin Cities. Wes, how did you get started in the local record business?
Well, I had decided to look for something different after the group that I was last with. I'd been with the Mystics, and then we had, for a short period of time, a few months, had a group called Mystic Evolution. That did not work out very well, and at that particular juncture, I was trying to figure out what to do. I called Ira because he had been our producer in the Mystics for the record Pain that we had done. And I said, Heilitzer Brothers, who was run by and owned by his dad and his uncle, Amos Heilitzer and Danny Heilitzer, and Ira worked for them. They, at that particular time, were the world's largest record distributor. So I called them and just nonchalantly asked whether or not there was an opportunity to get into the record business, to the real music side, the business side of the music business.
And what did Ira have to say?
Well, it was kind of unusual, or comical, actually, because he asked me, he said, well, I've got two things. He said, the warehouse or promotion. And obviously the promotion sounded better. And there was an individual working there by the name of Pat Devine. Now, it was kind of funny because Pat and I, seems like I had followed his career around. He had worked as a booking agent at Central Booking, and for a short period of time, I took a leave from the Mystics and went to work as a booking agent, taking Pat's place there. And then he went and took a place, a promotion, doing record promotion for Heilitzer's. So I called Pat, and Pat says, oh, you should definitely do this. Well, Ira had left me word to come in on a Monday morning and meet with their HR guy and talk to him about the position. And that was it. So Monday morning came, I walked in and asked for the HR director and went in and spoke with him. Told him, Ira told me to come in for the promotion job. So he took me to the office, showed me the desk, and at that point I joined two other people in that department. That was Kerry Knodel and Jerry Bix. And I sat down, took over the desk, and I was told that by Jerry, who was head of the department, just kind of follow me, and we went out and met with a couple of the jocks. And I was just kind of getting the idea of what was going on, and they said I would be handling A&M. Monday morning of the following week came, and Ira had been gone the week I actually did come in. So the following week when he showed up, he came in, he said, what are you doing here? And I said, well, you said record promotion. I came in and met with HR. He said, well, I just wanted him to interview you. I didn't know he was going to hire you. HR obviously took it from the way I presented it, that Ira had already picked me. At any rate, I was already in the desk, so we went forward from there. He lined things up with A&M, and the first record I got to promote was called Close to You by the Carpenters. Now, keep in mind, I have no idea really what I'm doing, except that I'm supposed to get all the disc jockeys, meet them, get a relationship with them and the program directors in the five-state area and get them to play the record. Somehow it wasn't too hard to get them to play Close to You. It was number one before I even got out there. So I was out chasing around with this record and having everybody call me because they were burning through copies and needed more, and I just kept sending them records.
So the first record you work with turns out to be Close to You, a gigantic hit with the Carpenters. What happens next?
Well, it was literally within a couple of weeks of that record that I was told I was going to now promote Elektra Records in addition. So I was introduced to those people, and they said, we have a new record coming out by a group called Bread, called Make It With You. So they shipped me those singles, and obviously we all know what happened to that record.
Another national
That went number one in a few weeks. So I was getting pretty friendly with everybody, and then I couldn't believe it, but literally a couple of weeks later, and this kind of continued for, I used to get new labels every other week. But the third one was Blue Thumb. It was a label that Leon Russell had started. It was Dave Mason, Only You Know and I Know. So that came that came out as a number one record. So here I am as a new promotion guy on the block, and within the first 2 months, I have 3 number one records in a row, and I felt like everybody's best friend. So that's where I started in the business, and from there it just continued on to more lines, more labels. Eventually, by the time I left, I had 180 labels that I was promoting.
How long did you stay with Heilitzer Brothers?
I stayed with them 3 years. Went from being in the department as a promotion man to eventually being the only one in the department with all the lines, and I had a mailing man and a secretary and 180 labels, so my day was pretty busy. It got to the point where it was very exciting. Obviously had something going all the time. The stories would be endless to talk about all the various records and releases that came through that period of time. But at that time, I really felt that I needed to have a change. Where there was only a few guys in record promotion, it was starting to be seen more as a position, and there were more people coming into that as a career nationally. So you had people in our market then doing only one record company, and I thought, well, that would be kind of nice to only have one label. I thought I'd really kind of gone as far as I could go with Heilitzer's.
Just for the record, where was the Heilitzer Brothers office located?
7600 Wayzata Boulevard.
Okay.
Can't believe I remember the address. But they kept an inventory of several million albums. I do recall I was one of the few people in the entire complex, several hundred people, that could literally go in the back and pull anything I wanted and not be questioned, because I had to get out to see people and I had to get albums out there. And so it was a fun job.
So what's your next move in the record business?
Well, at that point, I gave my notice. That was a very trying moment, because they had given me this break to get in there and learn the business and to meet a lot of people. And not just meet people in the business, but Heilitzer's as being the largest distributor. I mean, at that time, the number was 67% of all the pre-recorded product in the United States went through one of his warehouses. So being the head of promotion for that organization put me in a posture where I got to meet just about anybody I needed to meet in the actual record business. So from there, I did give my notice. There was this particular day that I remember being told, Wes Hayne, report to Mr. A's office.
Mr. A was?
Amos Heilitzer. Amos at that time, remember, at any time, very successful person and a very powerful person for his position in the industry. And I distinctly remember going into his office, and at that time, I was in my mid-20s. In fact, I was 24 years old, I think. And he said, I won't tell you exactly what he said, because I shouldn't be saying that, but to paraphrase it, it was, what do you think I'm running here, some type of a training school? And he said, if you quit, you'll never work any place in the record business, ever, anywhere. It was kind of it was more than just a slight threat. I told him, I said, I just need a change. I need to do something different. He said, I could promise you that I could keep you in a job the rest of your life. And I said, I'm sure you could, but what would it be? And I said, no, I'm going to have to stick with my notice. So at that point, it was very clear that I was blackballed and went back to my desk with a one-week notice. It was 2 weeks. And throughout that 2 weeks, I started to get these kind of underground calls, you know, heard you're quitting. What are you going to be doing? And I said, well, and there were other things. I mean, I knew a lot of people. I'd been nominated twice for Promotion Man of the Year by Billboard. And so there were things that, you know, I felt I was comfortable in knowing my job. But I also felt my career was over. And I would tell everybody very honestly that, you know, no, you don't want me. Mercury Records called, and this is what's going on. And they called out of Chicago and a couple others. And then the Friday I was actually quitting, I had Dave Wolfson. Can't believe I remembered his name. He was a regional guy, sales guy out of Chicago for MCA. And he came in the office at the distributor in Minneapolis where I was. Came in my office, and he said, I heard you're quitting. I said, yes. In fact, today's my last day. He says, "Where are you going?" I said, "Well, I'm not going anywhere." I said, "The story is," and I related the story to him. He says, "Hang on." And he went somewhere. I had no idea. He came back about a half hour later, and he said, "We'd like to hire you." And I said, "I don't know that that's a good idea." And so I ended up getting a phone call when I got home that night, and that was from Pat Pipolo, who was the national promotion guy out of L.A. for MCA. And he said, "No, we want to hire you." Explained it all over again. I said, "Are you guys not getting this?" And he can shut you down. I mean, he doesn't have to. I've seen him just shut an album down. The Godfather theme with, who did the cover on that? Andy Williams. I will guarantee you, if you checked on the sales, there's probably not more than a dozen copies sold in the United States. And that's another story for another time. But at any rate, he ended up passing that night. He said, "You know, we still want you." The next morning, I get Rick Frio call me. Rick is the national sales manager, and he's reading this whole thing, and I'm feeling very warm about the fact they want me. Sunday morning, I get the phone call from Mike Maitland. Now, Maitland had just built Warner Brothers and decided to go over and become president of MCA. And to get that name on the phone and say, "Wes, we want you to work with us, and here's the deal. Whatever time it takes for Amos to calm down and get over this, he's going to calm down. Everything will be okay. In the meantime, you know, why don't you come on out to L.A., take some time. We're going to start you right now, same salary you had before, and we'll take care of everything." And I'm sitting there thinking, it's kind of scary to be without credit cards on Saturday and Sunday. And here's Mike Maitland on the phone. I'm feeling very honored. Actually saying, I said, "Well, how long are you willing to do this?" He says, "Well, if it takes 4, 5, 6 months." I said, "You'd pay for me to be sitting around Los Angeles for 5, 6 months? And he said, "Well," he says, "you know, we want you." So I said, "You know, I'll do it. However I work it out, I'm not interested in coming out to L.A. and hanging out. But I said, I'll do it." That night, it had to be around 11 o'clock at night, I get a phone call. It's a Sunday night, 11 o'clock, and it's Ira, Amos's son. And he goes, "Okay," he says, "who are you working for?" And I said, "Ira." I said, "You know, your dad blackballed me." I said, there's no way I'm going to." He says, "Don't give me that." He says, "Who are you working for?" And I said, "You know, hey, you're making this really hard for me." He said, "Now look at it." He says, "I'll square it with the old man. Just tell me who it is you're working for. We'll work it out." And I said, "Okay." I said, "I trust you." I said, "I'm working for MCA." Sounded like the song. And he just chuckled and he said, "Good choice, good choice. We'll get this squared away." He said, "I'll call you tomorrow." And he called me by tomorrow, the next afternoon. He said, "I was in with Amos today." He said, "We walked it through," and he said, "He's fine with everything, and you're square." And that was it. I called the home office in L.A., and I was on board with MCA. And that led me to their annual meeting, which was coming up about 2 or 3 weeks later, and put me in a meeting in Cleveland, which is one of the reasons I have never been back to Cleveland to this day. Yeah, it's nothing against people from Cleveland. It had to do with my circumstances. But at that point, I also had an interesting time leaving, because Ira said, "I'll tell you what, won't have any problems," but he says, "You have to break the next guy in." I said, "Okay, and you have to help us find somebody." And I had been kind of looking around, hoping that, you know, there wouldn't be any problem in filling my gap, which I didn't think would take much. But a friend of mine, Ron Geslin, had a music store up on Central, and he had another one down in Dinkytown. And he probably argued this comment. I don't know how well the stores did. I didn't think they probably did all that well for him, but I remember I bought a waterbed and a few other things from him. And at any rate, I said, "Ron, this is a deal. You ought to get into this. You ought to be a promotion guy and take my gig." And he said, I've got the stores. And I said, "Forget the stores. Sell the stores." I said, you don't understand. I said, "You know, you're right for this job." And of course, his wife, Linda, you know, it was really kind of a trying moment to try to make that decision, I'm sure. But he actually did make the decision with me pushing him. He went in for the job, and there wasn't any question he was qualified for it.
So he took over your former position at Heilitscher Brothers.
Right. And then I was told that...
Same Ron Geslin
from Hot Half Dozen, which is the reason the Mystics hired me as a sax player, is because he was a... They had two sax players. So at any rate, Ronnie, I was told I had to take him out and train him in, introduce him to people. And I thought, well, this ought to be fun. So I got together with Ronnie and said, I'll take out a North Dakota run. And we'll see the guys at, you know, in Fargo, KMFG, in Bismarck, KFYR. And then we went down to Sioux Falls, KISD. We went out to Rapid City. And I can't recall the call letters. There were two reporting stations out there. But we did this round. And we flew into North Dakota, and rented a, into Fargo, and rented a car and started this backward trip around. At any rate, the funny thing was is that you have a credit card, and, you know, you, when you're on the road, you learn to live on that credit card. It's all expensed. This wasn't, you know, this, there wasn't anything illegal about it. It was just the way the record business was. I mean, you didn't lose that credit card because that was your meals and your transportation, everything you did. So at any rate, he ended up, I took him up to Fargo. And the first night we were there, we met with the disc jockeys from KMFG. And it was funny because Ron looks a lot like John Denver. And in those, at that time, Denver was still alive. He actually would have people come up and ask him for his autograph. And he would always get a kick out of it, make a joke, and he'd sign it.
They would actually think he was John Denver?
Oh, absolutely.
And ask for John Denver to sign an autograph?
Absolutely.
And he would say what?
He'd sign a John Denver.
Now, the reason all this is funny, and I'll jump ahead and jump back real quick, is that Ron went on to become president of RCA Records. And so at any rate, we were going to dinner with the disc jockeys. So we walked into this restaurant, and everyone knows in a town like Fargo, North Dakota, they know the disc jockeys. So we walk in, and the first thing... They go ahead and seat everybody, and I kind of lay back, and I told the waitress, I said, gee, I said, this is kind of a special occasion. We have John Denver with us, and it's his birthday. So with that said, we sat down and started our dinner, and of course, you could just tell by looking around the restaurant, people started looking, and people started walking by our table just to get a good view of Denver. And at the end of the night, out come the cakes, and everybody in the restaurant sings happy birthday. And Ron just settles right in with it and starts signing autographs. And the guys from the stations were just, and they were just falling apart. So we had a good time in Fargo. Went to Bismarck, and, well, you know, there's not much in Bismarck. We go to one station for lunch, and he said, well, what do we do for the afternoon? I said, well, let's go play tennis. And he said, we didn't bring tennis rackets. And I said, well, there's a sporting goods store. Sounds like a restaurant. I said, we'll go over and buy some rackets. So we played some tennis in the afternoon and then went on down to Sioux Falls and whatever. When we came back, I don't know how big his bill was, but Ira called me and chewed me out over the fact that, you know, I know you, he says, I know you spent three times more than you had to. And he says, I just wanted you to know I wasn't dumb enough not to notice it. But at any rate, we had a fun trip and broke Ronnie into the business, and I went on to MCA.
And what happens at MCA?
Well, at that point, Jerry Bix, who I had started with at Heilitzer's, had moved over to MCA. He was a one-man band. He had a small office, and he was expected to be the sales manager, promotion manager, and every other thing, and do all the mailings for MCA for a five-state area. So Jerry was really buried. Consequently, we both ended up, it was really good to work with Jerry, and we ended up in Cleveland at this convention, as I was saying, a couple weeks later. Out of 26 markets, our market was number 26. So, I mean, here I am showing up as the new guy on the block with the least amount of sales, and we have Heilitzer's, which is ordering big numbers when you have something successful. And so at any rate, that's one of the things about Cleveland. But while we're there, the promotion guys pulled together, and they pulled me in and said, okay, we have a gal coming from Australia, and we're going to see what you can do. She's hitting your market first. And back then, it was like Gordy Singer, and those guys had the college touring, the bookings. And they had Olivia Newton-John as somebody new on a college tour going through North South Dakota. So this was going to be my first test. So I remember going, driving my car out to Spearfish, South Dakota, to meet Olivia. And I believe I was with Greg Inhofer and Bob Strength, and all these guys had their band at the time. And I think it was Pepper Fogg that actually became her backup band for that tour. So that was very, I ran into all those guys at Spearfish. Never knew that existed out there. And then we traveled up north to some place in western North Dakota. And I remember KFYR, which is a 5,000 watt non-directional powerful station. I remember with Olivia in my car flying towards Bismarck because we had an interview to do. And by this point, her record had broken out on Billboard. It was just getting started for national attention. I remember rolling into some guy's record store because we couldn't get to the station on time and telling him that this is Olivia Newton-John. We have to do an interview. It's going to be on KFYR, and we have to do it right now. Where's your phone? And he looked somewhat confused and pointed to his phone, and we got on the phone. They patched us into the radio station, and Olivia did this interview. I'm sure he's still talking to people about it to this day. So he ended up, we ended up going through and getting back here, and then by the time she got back to Minneapolis a week later, it was 67 or 68 with a bulletin billboard.
That
would
let me be there.
Yep. We said goodbye, and she took off, and then right after that, Elton came out with his new album. And
Elton John.
Yeah, and that was the one that really hit, and he was on Uni. And then, I mean, MCA just hit. In a matter of 4 or 5 months, it was just one after another, Lynyrd Skynyrd. And I mean, so literally 1 year later, when I was actually getting ready to quit MCA, they had let us pick our office, and we picked an office in the Ivy Tower downtown Minneapolis, which had like 3 rooms. It was actually the first skyscraper, albeit it's not that high. That's where the Ivy Hotel is now. And it was 3 rooms and 3 people. We had a secretary, and it was Jerry and I, and we were probably the only record guys for MCA, promotion guys in the country that actually had a nice office. But we came in 1 year number one out of 26 markets. And of course, that's because of the huge volume that Heiligers bought for all the other warehouses. So that was kind of fun. And then at that point, I got an idea that I wanted to start my own record company.
And this is roughly what year now?
This would be 1974. So at that point, I ran into, Danny Johnson, I had known. And we got together, and Cliff Siegel. Cliff was working promotion for Warner Brothers. And I believe he was, wasn't he? Yeah. And the three of us got together and talked about starting a record label. And it was our business model to think, you know, hey, we need to have a recording studio so we can offset the cost of all the recording time. We can use off time with the recording studio. So we started walking around town, and we were still all working in our prospective areas. And I think we met with everybody, Cookhouse and Sound 80, and then Audio Tech Systems with Dan Holmes. And everybody turned us down. So we weren't quite as hot as we thought we were, but we had some good ideas. And we all kind of gave that up. And then it was a couple months later, Dan Holmes called me, and he said, he's been thinking about it. And he said, I'd be willing to try it with one person. He said he had a, Audio Tech was kind of a strange recording facility because it was actually a publicly held company. It had 400 shareholders. He had taken a public on the local exchange. And that's how he had funded his company. And he knew that the recording business is only as good as you book up the studio. Once the studio is booked, your whole revenue base is done. That's it. That's as far as you can go. So he wanted to start a record company. So that's where we started meeting. Came up with the idea of ASI Records. I said I'd like to finally made the decision to do it. And I continued on with MCA for a few more months. While we were starting to set up everything at ASI. Then I gave my notice at MCA and made my move over. And that's approximately 1974.
So you and Dan Holmes then are the head of ASI?
Right. He was the president. I was executive vice president. You know, nice compensation package for stock options and whatever for the public stock and whatever. But the important thing was is that we had a recording facility that could continue recording, and the idea was we'll continue to find good acts. There's plenty of good talent, and sooner or later, not costing us an arm and a leg to record, sooner or later we'll find somebody that that'll hit.
Do you recall the first album that came out on ASI?
Sure do. We actually had three albums we were pressing at the time that Dan called and said, when are you going to quit MCA? And I had to quit because they were in shipment, and that's when I resigned from there. The first one was Haze by Purple Haze, and that was a nine-piece group, heavy, heavy R&B group, incredible talent. As a real diverse item, the second album was a comedy album by Dudley Riggs that we did, and we promoted that, thought we'll promote that to the NPR stations around the country. So those two albums were actually our lead-off. Before we hardly got started, I Do Love My Lady by Haze started to get airplay, and we were thinking, this is pretty strange because, you know, it was a black record. I had actually worked for Motown through the distributor at one time, but I had never really been in contact with all the black stations around the country by any means. So all of a sudden, we're being called in to, it's just Dan and I. We have a couple of engineers working in the studio, but it's just he and I for the record company. And we're starting in the morning, literally starting East Coast. It's 6 o'clock in the morning. We're calling, we cut it with the Mason-Dixon line, and one took north, one took south, and we went east to west until 9 o'clock at night. We're still calling. It was just a bizarre amount of work that
you're calling radio stations.
And okay. We're calling black stations that Manuel Minto III out of, you know, VON in Chicago, you know, like they want to talk to me. So we had some real complications, but after a while we got a certain technique going that we simply call and act really bold to the point where they'd almost wonder who we were. And then we started to work out with other consultants, and I remember talking to James Cleveland, and I mean all sorts of people. And we actually did get some substantial airplay on that record.
And who was doing the distribution?
Well, that was another whole game. We had to set up national distribution, and nobody had national distribution up here since Amos had his own label called Soma 10 years earlier. Nobody had achieved that. So, well, what I did and Dan, I mean, we copied A&M, looked at all their distributors, and of course A&M's pattern put about 6 or 7 of 26 markets central in Amos's camp. His distributors were the big ones in those markets. So to walk into somebody, you know, in Detroit and say that, you know, we've already got Heilitzers in these 7 markets, and we got MS in Chicago. I can't even think I'm coming up with these names. And so-and-so in Shreveport, and whatever. They'd look at you and go, well, what are you coming with? And they said, well, we have 6 albums coming, and here's what we're doing. And that was it. They'd sign you up. They saw 6 albums coming, and then we were talking about other distribution agreements. And what we did is we went to Natural Life. They had about 6-7 albums. So we took it and started a jazz label. We did another album called Sound of the Wasp, which was 2 jazz gentlemen, very renowned. In fact, one of them's a professor, I believe, today at Berkeley. So we did some jazz. We did actually did a gospel album by Vera Jenkins had the Sounds of Blackness in the background, which went on to get a Grammy Award. And that's the one I remember I had called James Cleveland for some help on and some advice. So we did some really wild things. And we had enough volume in album product that we were putting together that the distributors actually signed on. And about every 2 weeks, we had a press release going into Billboard that would say ASI Records out of Minneapolis adds 3 distributors and Schwartz Brothers in Washington, D.C. And people would read that and go, how in the world did you get them? But, I mean, it was a lot of it was piggybacking through the Heilitzer Musicland people. And so we set up a really interesting, very solid group of distributors. Dan and I went on a final tour to lock everything down because Allegheny Airlines had a sale, and you paid so much and you got as many tickets as you could take without visiting the same place twice, other than their hub. It literally had a half inch, three quarters of an inch packet of tickets. We were gone for 26 days and visited, we went from here to Buffalo, where we were snowed in for 3 days, I recall. Spent most of those 3 days at the 747 lounge at the airport there. And then we went to Boston, Hartford, New York, New Jersey, down to Atlanta, Shreveport, Dallas, St. Louis, all the distributor areas. And we locked everybody in. And then we went ahead and even set up distribution with SMS in Japan through the Yamaguchi family. And then we also did CBS in Canada, or RCA in Canada. So we set up distribution the first 6 months, 7 months of our existence.